1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, hello, everybody. You know a little bit about me, so I wanted to find out a little bit about you. I bet you in this hall right now are current communitarians, current community seekers, soon-to-be community founders, and people that will be living in community sooner or later, or maybe are now. So I'm wondering if I can just check that out with you. Is there anybody here who has visited an intentional community? Could I see a slow show of hands? Oh, God bless you. Great. Lives in an intentional community. Okay. Oh, man. All right. All the folks from Northwest Intentional Community Association here in the front. Plans to form one. Oh, this is great. You're my folks. Already has formed one. You are my heroes. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Well, so 10 years ago, I started doing a newsletter about how to form intentional communities. I was doing journalism as forcing function. I didn't know how. I wanted to have a quarterly deadline to force me to find out. So I did a little tiny newsletter called Growing Community Newsletter. Anybody in here a journalist who ever does forcing functions on themselves? Ah, you know how to do that. Okay. So I caught the notice of the Fellowship for Intentional Community, which publishes the Big Communities Directory, and had just acquired Communities Magazine. And they were looking for an editor for Communities Magazine. And they said, well, we'll interview you, but you have to come across the country from Colorado, across the country, across to Evergreen State College, where we're holding the 1993 Celebration of Communities Conference. We're going to have a party for 1,000 people. And here, you can put your tent up on the median strip of the parking lot. So that's what I did, myself and the 999 other people that were having a fabulous celebration here 10 years ago. And there are people out here in the audience who were there, including some Evergreen students who are now 10 years older. So can I see a show of hands? Who was there then? All right. Great. Thank you so much. Okay, so I started working for Communities Magazine as the editor, and I've been doing it for 10 years now. And 4 times a year we put out an issue, and that means 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 or 15 articles, and there are many more than that that see the light of print that pass across my desk. So I was getting quite an education in what is this thing called forming intentional community and living in them, and what are the challenges and what are the rewards. And then I started visiting communities and interviewing founders and asking them, well, what seems to work? And what would you do again, and what do you recommend people do? What would you never do again and you don't recommend people do? And what has happened? And as a result of my inquiry, which was informal but relentless, I found that there was about 90% of communities that failed, of those started in the 1990s, and about 10% that succeeded. And what I mean by succeeded is they got the land they were looking for, and they got moved on, and they got all living there together and proceeding apace with starting to manifest their goals. I consider success progressively meeting your goals, and I consider failure in the form of communities disbanding the whole group. I don't really mean that's a failure necessarily, but I mean, you know, they disbanded. So 90% disbanded and 10% succeeded. Now, this is not any kind of massively professional statistic. This is just me in my armchair figuring it out, armchair statistician. But across the country on the other side of the Mississippi River in the mountains of western North Carolina was Valerie Naiman, who was at the celebration and who was in the process of forming Earth Haven Eco Village with her friends. And she was looking into all the same research I was. And she came up with the same statistic, 90% disbanding, 10% succeeding. So I wanted to know, what were the 10% doing? What were the 90% doing and not doing? And were they doing different but opposite things? Wouldn't you want to know that? What's the success formula here? So I looked into it. And sure enough, the 10% were doing these basic, important, necessary structures. And the 90% were either not doing them or doing only some or doing them sort of haphazardly. And I thought, oh my God, people don't need to reinvent the wheel. There's a bit of a formula here. This can be done. People can do this. Somebody ought to write this down. Somebody out there ought to do something about this. So this gigantic index finger hanging out in the region of the Horsehead Nebula, turned around and pointed at me and said, "You will do it." So that is how I come to stand upon this stage before you today. It was that finger. So I decided I would start doing workshops about this, and I do. I started doing workshops in 1997, and the first one I did was at Fairhaven College in Bellingham, Washington. I was totally impressed. It sort of made me feel wonderful that college could be like that, and students could be like that, and curricula could be like that. Then I did one at Lewis and Clark College in Portland a year and a half ago. Once again, I was totally impressed. Then I came here. And I thought, oh my God, this is how people can be at the age of 18 and 21 and 22 and 19. They can be this dedicated and this impassioned and this informed. How wonderful. I've been waiting for you. My generation is waiting for you to come along and join us and do the good things. So I'm so glad to meet you. I'm so glad to be here. If I could go back in time and get a degree, I'd come here. But paradoxically, if I got a degree, I'd just be doing what I'm doing, so I suppose I could skip that step. Don't tell your parents I said that. So I wanted to talk with you a little bit about eco-villages and what I've come to learn about them. So I thought I'd tell you what I have in mind for this evening, which is only partially up to me and also up to you, because I want to have a big fat chunk of time for your comments and questions and so on. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about various classic definitions of intentional communities and eco-villages, and describe Earth Haven Eco-Villages, Eco-Village, where I live in North Carolina, and describe Dancing Rabbit Eco-Village and Eco-Village at Ithaca and Los Angeles Eco-Village, because they all describe different aspects of coming at this thing called using your life and how you live as political activism, as environmental activism. Then, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the organizations that foment revolution via eco-villages and intentional communities, and how you can get involved, how you can visit them, how you can go do work exchanges with them, how you can go around and see if any of them are for you, how you might be, if you have interest in starting one. And also talk about some of the pitfalls, some of the challenges, and the things that I found among the 90% that they weren't doing and among the 10% that they were, if you'd like to hear that, which usually people want to hear that. So I also have an 11-minute little video of some people at Earth Haven whom you can meet, with them talking to you via Jeff Cozney's excellent videography, telling you why they're doing what they're doing. So how does that sound? Okay. And then we'll be hearing from you, I hope. Okay. So my favorite definition of eco-villages comes from Robert and Diane Gilman, who helped come up with putting a name on this thing back in the early 1990s with Ross and Hilda Jackson in Denmark, where the Gilmans were visiting the Jacksons. And they said, what if there was a kind of activism that involved where you lived, and it was a small community or even up to village scale, and everybody was living according to all these sustainable principles? There are some people maybe starting to do that. Maybe there's some traditional groups doing that. What should we call it? So eco-village is the name that they got at that time. And this is how the Gilmans described it in their 1991 book, which is called Eco-Villages and Sustainable Communities. It's still available from the Context Institute. There's another book of exactly the same name, which is the findings from the 1995 Findhorn Foundation conference on eco-villages, but these are two different books. So Robert and Diane Gilman said an eco-village is, and they were talking theoretically because they meant what we hope is going to happen in terms of these villages, is a human scale, full-featured settlement in which human activities are harmlessly integrated into the natural world in a way that is supportive of healthy human development and which can be successfully continued into the indefinite future. So what does that mean? Human scale. We all know each other. If we looked around in this room and we saw the 63 people that are here, or 78 people, I'm not good at that kind of thing, but if we did, and we were in an eco-village that was human scale, we would all know each other. We'd know each other's names. We'd recognize each other by sight. And when we're making decisions together, we would know that there's not so many of us that each of us can't influence the outcome of our decisions. We're human scale. We're small enough. How small is that? I knew you were going to ask that. Some people guess about 20. Others, like at the small end, well, from about 20 to, 100, 200, 300. Chris Mayer, who was on the panel with me the other day, did any of you see that panel in the library? I'd like to respectfully disagree with Chris. And that's a principle of consensus decision making. You can respectfully disagree with each other. I asked him later, why did you say that Crystal Waters and maybe Oroville, but definitely the farm and, what was the other one, Findhorn, were the best examples of eco-villages? And Chris said, well, because a village needs to be at least 500 people so that you don't have recessive genes creating kids that look a little funny. You know, you have enough population for reproductive health. And I recognize that that is a classic definition of village by those folks who study, you know, the sociology of population size and so on. But, gosh, I beg to differ. I think that people who started the eco-village movement had no intention of using that classical academic definition of what a village is for what they call this little thing they were coming up with called eco-villages. So I don't think there's a relationship, actually. So I think that eco-villages are any size that people happen to come up with as they're growing themselves towards their goals, which might range from 12 to 300 so far, and the statistics aren't all in, and we'll keep our eye on them, and we'll let you know. So anyway, human scale. Full-featured settlement. We live here. We know that, right? We work here. We don't have to go driving off the property to go earn a living. We can earn it right here because we telecommute, or we work for another community member who has a business, or we formed a worker-owned co-op. Maybe we formed a worker-owned co-op doing this, and y'all formed a worker-owned co-op doing that, and that's another way to make a living on the land. Maybe the community itself has put aside some of its income, which it gets from our dues, to hire some of us to be doing gardening or maintenance or cooking or something like that. We work for the community. There's a number of ways that people in intentional communities and eco-villages can make a living on the land. Okay, we live here, we work here. Our social life is here. Surely we can get in our car or our horse or our bicycle and go to town to a movie, but we can also do yoga here, our study group here, our Spanish potluck is here, our Tuesday pizza and movie night is here. All kinds of things that we want to do socially with each other is here. Not to mention us. Gosh, we're fascinating conversationalists around the old community dinner table. We're more fun than a barrel of monkeys. We don't need to go off the site for any other monkeys. We're doing fine right here. Okay. So our social life is here. Our spiritual life is here. We can certainly go off-site to go to that yoga retreat, the meditation retreat, or church. And if we want to stay here, there's plenty of support, acknowledgement, allowing tolerance and support for our spiritual path, our spiritual practice, whatever it might be. We might be all doing the same one, or have many multiple different ones that we each do, with no requirement that we do anything at all, but that we're supportive of each other doing it. So that's what is meant by full-featured settlement. Okay, harmlessly integrated into the natural world. You know what that is, because you teach it and learn it here and create programs about it and knock people's socks off with it. We're not harming the microorganisms by the stuff we're doing. We're not harming the soil, the water, the air. Do aspiring eco-villages in fact harm the soil, the air, the water? Yeah, they're doing construction. They're driving. At Earth Haven, we drive across three creeks with the silt going downstream where the fish go. Oh, so sorry. The fish don't like it at all. They flap their little fins and tell us to please get it together and make bridges. And we did this last year, our first bridge, and we shall make more. So it's an ideal to aspire to. And human activities are supportive of healthy human development. We're in the equation, too. We're having a good time. We're thriving. We're not just surviving. We're thriving. Asterisk. I'll get back to that. Okay, last one. Successfully continued into the indefinite future. Thank you, Six Nations Iroquois, for giving us the phrase, figure out if your decision is beneficial for the next seven generations, because that's essentially the same thing. So, I have a question for you. Are there any eco-villages in the world yet? Yes? Some yes? Yeah? Yeah? Really? I hope so. Well, I actually think there aren't. And here I am from a place that dares to call itself Earth Haven Eco Village. What cheek. I think there aren't because there hasn't been any opportunity to see the part about successfully continued into the indefinite future. Also, I really don't know of any eco-village projects where they're full featured settlements and everything takes place there, and where there's just no harm going on at all to any part of the environment, and everybody's just as happy as a clam. I think everybody's working their butt off and going like this at the end of the day because it's so hard to do this, because eco-village activists are going against the grain of North American culture and European culture and Japanese culture and South American culture. Where eco-village activists are, they're not just doing what's difficult, they're doing it in an atmosphere that doesn't really support it. So I'd say that this is still a nascent life form. So I call them aspiring eco-villages. And I'd like to really suggest to you that you pick up on that term, aspiring, and mentally think it when someone says they live in an eco-village. So I think I forgot to even talk about what I suggest is a nice definition for intentional communities. So I'd like to run one of those by you real quickly, where a group of people live with each other or next door to each other, or at least close enough so they can carry out their common purpose together. Well, that's pretty good. Co-housing communities, common purpose, great neighborhood, wonderful place to raise children, wonderful place to grow older. Are many of you familiar with co-housing communities? Okay, great. Anybody thinking, what the heck is that? Show of hands. Okay. In a nutshell, co-housing communities where a group of people who may not necessarily know each other to start with design and develop their own small neighborhood. They sometimes do it all themselves, and sometimes they hire a development partner who's a professional developer with a green-leaning and progressive attitude. And they create a neighborhood of from between 24 housing units to maybe 42 on the average. They have a common house that they all own together, where they have a kitchen, dining room, children's play area, teenage hangout room, laundry room, place where you get your mail, optional dinners there, which they rotate cooking and cleanup maybe 3-4 nights a week. It's the fastest growing kind of intentional community in North America. And I'd say that it's mainstream accessible. It's built all at once. It uses bank loans and mortgage, and basically means signing contracts with the man. But it also includes lots and lots of community for otherwise folks who'd be living in nuclear, family, isolated, neon, plastic, suburban America, but they might as well be in a co-housing community, being an advocate for community. I love co-housers and co-housing, but I do have a complaint about them. Don't tell anybody I said this, which is they think they invented community, you know? They'll say, well, in co-housing, you just learn what your issues are. And I'm thinking, you know, people have been doing that in community for 40 years, for 50 years, for 200 years. Well, in community, you can share stuff, and you don't have to all buy the same thing. And we do that, I mean, co-housing, and we do that at co-housing. And I'm thinking, excuse me, but we've been doing that in the intentional community movement for, you know, eons already. But that's okay. It's a small complaint, isn't it? They're doing it, and I'm glad. Common purpose, student housing co-op. I don't think there's very many in the Pacific Northwest, but they're big in Austin, Berkeley, Madison, and Ann Arbor, student housing co-ops, and Stanford, where you own a house together with other fellow students for a four-year period, and then you go off the deed, and a freshman comes on, and you've had some ownership and some shared decision-making, some shared resources. People who live in student housing co-ops are often so turned on by the experience, they go out and found communities. And Dancing Rabbit Eco Village, which we'll meet in a moment, was founded by some students from Synergy, the name of the co-op, one of the co-ops at Stanford. Common purpose, back to the land commune. You've heard of communes, perhaps, from the 60s. Got a bit of media attention. It's where you all wear tie-dye and go do nothing. That's not true. That's just a media stereotype that my job as Communities Magazine editor is to disabuse everybody of that notion. A commune is an economic term. It means we all put our money in the same pot, and then we have a stipend that we pay ourselves. We get room and board. We have a community business, and we take the profit from our community business and pay our community expenses with. And we ourselves don't take personal money. We go in with a shirt on our back, and 12 years later when we leave with a shirt on our back. We don't build equity, but we don't have to have a membership fee either. So there are some communes, income-sharing communities in the United States and Canada, even today, and they're doing just fine. They have more clout in the community's movement than their actual number. In my opinion, they're less than 1%. Although Laird Sandhill, who's a community's activist and my boss, he and I arm wrestle about this, and he thinks it's like 5 or 10%. And I say, oh, no, Laird, it's less than 5.5%. What do we know? Okay, so that's an intentional community. Eco-villages are a kind of intentional community. However, there are also educational centers whom the global eco-village movement says are also eco-villages because they're in the process of doing sustainability education. One could say that maybe Evergreen State College is an eco-village of a certain kind. I mean, that's a thought. Okay, let's talk about Earth Haven. I want to describe it to you. I'm so sorry that I don't have photos, slides, or interactive holograms for you. I'd love to. So I'm just going to have to use a visual picture and let your mind, the great creator, see it. So the founders of Earth Haven purchased their 320 acres of mountain forest with the idea of creating a village-scale community of 150 people. They bought the property in 1994, and today, 9 years later, it's the beginning of a real village. When they bought the property, it was all covered with young forest, 60-year-old trees that grew up out of the abandoned pastures and abandoned fields of the former residents of the area, who were people who grew corn. And do you know why they grew corn? It wasn't for corn cobs. It was for moonshine. Because the chestnuts had died and the Appalachian people had nothing else to make money with except illegal liquor. And so that's how we have depleted soils at Earth Haven today, because of all the corn grown on the very fields that are now covered with a 60, now 70-year-old forest. So when the founders of Earth Haven got there, there was a forest of relatively skinny trees, all with the same canopy, as Chris Farmer pointed out when in his sustainable forestry talk the other day, because they all grew up at the same time out of the same pasture, so to speak. And one little dirt road and one old abandoned cabin that was in the process of falling down, and it still is in that process. And that's what they bought. And they planned to have a self-reliant vision of a village where they grew their own food and had their own passive solar dwellings made of earth-built materials and had off-the-grid power and children and older folks and businesses and the whole nine yards. And there they're standing there in this forest. So here it is, 9 years later, and let me describe what it looks like to you. On a south-facing hillside in the center of the property is what we call the Hut Hamlet. It's tiny earth-plastered dwellings and one three-story residence. All of them have green metal roofs, and they're earth-plastered in various shades of peach and pink and yellow. The buildings are surrounded by small gardens, often solar panels, and sometimes young fruit trees, and the occasional chicken coop or a rabbit hutch. Nearby is a straw bale kitchen, dining room, bathhouse, with one, count them one, shower, and one, count them one, bathtub. And sometimes there's a line. And inside is a kitchen, and this is the first kitchen that was on the property. And over to one side is a constructed wetlands where the gray water from the shower in the kitchen goes into various series of beds and comes out a bullfrog pond. We didn't mean for it to be a bullfrog pond, but that's what it is now. One family there has, and this is no longer true, but I'm going to say it like it was because it's so colorful and wonderful, so we're going back in time a couple of months. One family there has leased a meadow in the center of the village where we'll find a cow and some milk goats and some chickens. And this family is doing grass rotational pasturing. Do you know what that is? This is a way of making this little plot of formerly depleted land really generate a lot of food. First of all, it was given seeds of grass and clover and various kinds of nutrient-rich soil amendments and nitrogen-fixing plants and grew up a little pasture. Oh. And the cow moves around in a movable fenced small pasture, and the goats move around in a movable fenced small pasture, and the chickens move around after them. And between the hoofs and the chicken claw tilling machines and the poop that goes everywhere, this is a rich and lush verdant meadow now. And out of it came, for the family, an income, a little income stream of eggs and milk. Don't tell anybody about the milk. Eggs and milk. And the rest of us had wonderful food grown right very in the heart center of our community, not to mention animal friends that we got to see when we walked by. Okay, what you will also find is down below that, a children's play area. And what you're going to hear, if you walk by and you're listening, is the sound of brooks and the sound of children playing and the sound of chickens clucking, an occasional moo or bleat. And you'll hear it hammering and the air compressor, because we're under construction everywhere. And you'll hear the whine of a bandsaw in the lumberyard. One of our founders, Chuck Marsh, said the whine of that bandsaw is the sound of freedom. He wrote that in Permaculture Activist magazine. He said, that's the sound of freedom. We mill our own lumber from our own trees that we felled on our own land to build our own passive solar dwellings without bank loans. And so that's the sound of freedom. Because isn't that what freedom is, really? Unhooking from the machine, the big machine. Okay. Other centers of village life here in the center of Earth Haven, and keep in mind, it's in the mountains, it's in the forest, and this is a little valley with three streams coming together, is the round timber frame council hall made of straw bale, straw clay, earth plastered, kind of a peach color. That's where we have meetings and committee meetings and dances and weddings and parties and contact improvisation and fights. The Trading Post Community Store, which offers snacks and camping supplies and cappuccino and chocolate and matches and tampons and tent tarps and tent pegs and little portable potties and cookies, all the kinds of things you'd need to camp out and have a good time and get stuff you needed, batteries. The White Owl Lodge, which is a members' cafe. It's not open to the public because it doesn't have that license, but it's a cafe for members, and it doubles as a place for morning yoga and meditation and as an evening coffee house, and there's living quarters upstairs. It's a timber frame building. It's extremely beautiful. Village Terraces, which is a three-story, 4,300 square foot, three-story multifamily building. It's got six apartments and two spaces for businesses for the people who live there, because they have their own businesses, some of them. And it's got common kitchen and bath facilities. And they call it the co-housing building because it's got common walls between the housing units, like an apartment building. And the folks there are going to attract other people to that Village Terraces neighborhood. We have 9 neighborhoods or 11 neighborhoods, and that's the name of one of them. And they're going to build another building, and everybody will use the common kitchen and bath facilities is their plan. And just up around the bend, going on up one of the roads, is the Benchmark neighborhood, where there's also a community building that's been built. The downstairs has a storage space that will one day be a wood shop. The second floor is the offices of the Permaculture Activist magazine. Does anybody know that magazine? Yeah. Produced and edited at Earth Haven. And the co-editor is Toby Hemingway, who's out here. Upstairs from that on one side is an artist studio and loft where he does his artwork and lives, and one of the members of that neighborhood. And the other upstairs is the bedroom, sitting room of another member there. In that neighborhood, one house is going up right now, and the fellow who has that house is starting a permaculture plant nursery, which is going to be yet another business at Earth Haven that will employ some people part-time. So as we go out further out the gravel roads that lead out from the center, and I want you to think of a spiral nebula here, and in the epicenter of the community are all these little huts and chickens and goats and cows and the bandsaw and so on. And then out these roads that go out this way and that way are other neighborhoods where people are building their homes. Not very many people yet, and not very big homes, because remember, we don't got no bank loans. And one of the fellows out in one of the neighborhoods, actually my next-door neighbor, has a Xeroxing business. So you don't have to go to Asheville to get stuff. So he has a tool rental business. He has a woodworking wood shop that you can rent by the hour. And he will design and install your solar panels and your solar system. He'll design and install your plumbing, propane, or water. And that's all the things that he's doing to make a living there at Earth Haven. So you can, you know, one-stop shopping center, solar panels, Xeroxing, tool rental, and so on. So you kind of get the picture of trying to make a living on the land by offering various kinds of businesses and services. The idea is we make our money there, we spend our money there, and if we really have it together, and I hope that we will in future years, we'll save our money there in credit unions and so on, and invest our money there by putting it into businesses that members are going to start up, or putting it into home sites that members are getting loans for so they can build their houses. And that has happened to some degree. There are many loans hanging around in the ethers there between one member who has more money and another who has less and who's paying off the first one over time, known as friendly loans with low interest. So that's a little bit about Earth Haven. I'd like to give you an example of a typical day of me. Yes, the question is, do we have an alternate currency there? And we do, although it's not developed very much like Ithaca Hours are. What it is mostly is a way of using scrip to keep track of our community labor that we owe the community. So I'm going to give you an example of a typical day, but I'm also going to confess something. I've been visiting Earth Haven and being involved with it for 3.5 years. I've been a full member for 2 years, but I just moved there a month and a half ago. And that's, and although I was, you know, involved in many committees and went to the council meetings and was there quite a lot, the reason that I just got there is because it took a while to find a site, get approval for a site, get a site plan, get approval for a site plan, find somebody to clear the land, get the brush off the land, get the logs off the land, find somebody to build us a place, build a place, get our own utilities, because there's no utilities coming in from anywhere else. This takes a while. So my mom and I live together in a really small dwelling, and we've just been there a month and a half. So I'm going to give you a typical day, and this is just me. The typical days of other people will vary widely. So I get up in the morning and I remember what I learned from the night before when I called my neighbor who was selling my mom and I electricity from his solar panels and his generator. The night before I asked him how much electricity he might be likely to have. The next morning, which is based on how cloudy it was or wasn't, how sunny it was or wasn't, and whether the construction site on the other place, the other side of our place, was doing, was under full steam with hammer and compressors and table saws and so on. If so, I need to not turn on the juicer. Or my printer, though I can turn on my computer, but I can't print out. So I have to sort of like, if you didn't think we weren't all downstream from each other, this is a pretty good illustration that we are. And so I'm determining which things I am or am not going to use. At some point, my mom and I will have our own solar system, in which case we'll look at our own trimetric meter, which reads what the batteries are doing, and we will know that it's okay to turn on the juicer or not. So I'll do what I do. Empty the urine bucket that's underneath the compost toilet. We have a Swedish urine separator so that you aim your body properly so that pee goes front and other solid waste goes back. Then I go get a bucket of sawdust to replace the bucket of sawdust, which is which we use to bless the solid waste that we pour down that hole to the four directions. Then I'll take the compost outside and bury it in the yard because we haven't got our first head of livestock yet, which will be thousands of worms. We haven't got them yet, so I'm burying the compost in our little dirt parts behind the house. Then I'm taking the trash out here and there, and then I can start my day. So I'm doing a little work on Communities Magazine, but only typing. I'm not printing anything, because last night my neighbor Greg said, sorry, we're going to have to wait till it's sunny, and only if it's sunny. 8:30, I go down the road, cross over our first little low-water bridge, which we're all so very proud of, and we say to the fish downstream, oh, we hope you're liking this better now. Then I go across another bridge, which does another stream that doesn't have a bridge. I'm walking across these rocks, which sometimes are doing like that. Get across the bridge, go up a little hill, and up to the White Owl Cafe where the yoga is going on. And then I do some yoga. Finish with yoga, do a little meditation. I'm feeling happy as a clam. I've had 6 hugs, and I haven't even had breakfast. Then I go back home again. Well, I might stop off in the Hutt Hamlet to get my mail, and while I'm there, feeling gregarious, because how can you not in a place like this, I go over to the Hutt Hamlet kitchen and see who might be there. For no reason, you know, just to say hi. And I chat and hang out and visit, and then I go back. Might go back through one of the higher roads in the Hutt Hamlet, not the same road I came down, so I can stop off and see people if I have to tell them, oh, here's the minutes from that meeting we had, and oh, could you hand me back that video I loaned you, and so on. It's just kind of an excuse, because eco-villages, if they're designed right, force you into social interactions casually and informally as you're walking through the place. Then I cross over a beautiful little footbridge, go back over those rocks again, go back down the road, cross our beautiful low water bridge, hello fish, and back to my house where I work on Communities Magazine. Maybe by 12 or 1 if the sun's out, I can run my printer. And I can run my juicer, so I run in the kitchen, do some juicing. That afternoon I might have a meeting, so I walk back down that road, over the bridge, over the rocks, over another bridge, down to a big, big, huge house, 3.5 stories high, made entirely of the plywood from recycled cranberry juice pallets. I'm not kidding. So I have a meeting of, say, the promotions committee, and we say to ourselves, well, we can promote Earth Haven in all these ways, or maybe we shouldn't, because sometimes when people come here, they say, look at those piles of things. What are they? And we say, oh, those are highly valuable piles of salvaged materials. And some people say they're unsightly piles of junk. So there's this controversy. Do we even want to bring people here while it still looks like this? And then we say, oh, well, let's put it in our promotional literature, construction zone, wear your hard hat, so that nobody is fooled when they come there into thinking they're going to see house beautiful. They're going to see eco-village in process. So then after I'm done with the meeting, I go home, type up the minutes, go back down the road, then go back down the road, over those rocks again, to the White Owl Cafe where I pay my $5 to the dinner co-op there. This is one dinner co-op, although there are other dinner places. There are other kitchens having other dinners. And I have a delicious, fabulous gourmet meal cooked by the rotational cooks of the 12 permanent members of the dinner co-op. They've cooked. My $5 goes to pay the general upkeep of this place for the owner of it, who is currently not at Earth Haven, for propane and firewoods and so firewood logs. That is to pay the people who are chopping them and splitting, kindling and so on. And this pays for the food and it pays the cooks, and they rotate who the cooks are. And I don't have to do a thing except pay $5 and have a fabulous meal. Or I could go to the Hot Hamlet Kitchen. It's also $5 because I'm not a member of the dinner of the kitchen. If I was a member of the kitchen, I'd be paying a monthly rate and also have my turn cleaning and doing dishes and cooking. So I could go to either of them, or I could stay home. That night, it's pizza and movie night. Go back to the White Owl Lodge and watch a movie with a bunch of people. Then I go home. I'm living in paradise. Is it always wonderfully fun? Do we ever have any conflict? Yeah, we do. Sure. No more and no less than any other eco-village, I'm sure. But I hope that gives you a little bit of a sense of the fact that we're all downstream from each other. We're all upstream from each other, and we have to think about what we do because we have an effect on each other. You probably imagine that's true, and it surely is. Any questions or comments before we go to Dancing Rabbit? The question is, have we centralized electricity generation or solid waste disposal? Yes and no. Individual people who live in the Hot Hamlet and people who have begun to develop their home sites generate their own electric power or do it with a neighbor or purchase it from a neighbor with solar panels generally. In fact, in every case, solar panels. We, the community, do have a microhydro unit in one of the streams, and that is to provide electricity for a small part of the central part of the village. And as far as solid waste disposal, we have a centralized in the Hot Hamlet composting toilet for the Hot Hamlet. And then we have small little privies, usually with a Swedish urine separating device, all over the community. Okay, Dancing Rabbit. Dancing Rabbit, folks. Oh, sure. Yes, the question is, have we set aside any land that will be perpetual forest? Yes, we absolutely have. Ridgetops and steeper slopes. South-facing slopes in 11 identified areas are being cleared home site at a time for home sites, which will then be replanted with probably fruit and nut trees, other useful trees in home gardens. And the bench lands and the bottom lands, which are flat, are being cleared more slowly than many of us would like, for various members to, in the future, lease as agricultural sites to grow food to sell to the community. That's the plan, anyway. Yeah. Any other questions before we go to Missouri? The question is, what about schooling for the children? There's 60 people there right now, and maybe five or so are children more in the summertime, which doesn't relate to your question, since they're not going to school then. Some people take their children to one or more private schools in the area that are alternative schools. Farmer, do you know if anybody takes anybody to a public school? I don't think so. Various parents have from time to time, and some, I think, still are doing homeschooling. Yes, the Forest Children's Program is called program, not school, because there's a lot of licensing issues involved if you try to make your own school, you know. But the Forest Children's Program is a group of parents who've gotten together to do a sort of rotational child care and educating children about different things. And they've got some people in the community who they pay a little money to take more time and teach certain kinds of things. So that's really nice.
Do you have any self-imposed health, building, or environmental regulations?
Any self-imposed health, building, or environmental regulations? Yes, yes, and yes. Like many community groups, we have created agreements with ourselves for what we all are going to do and not do together for our own best interests. In terms of health, well, I think that what we do for the environment, we do for our health as well. We don't pollute the streams or pollute the ground. We have what is the equivalent of zoning restrictions and building codes, but that sounds so legalistic. It's just really our agreements. So when you get a site plan, you have to have it approved by the site planning committee, and the committee is going to look at how's the water runoff, does it pollute any stream, does it erode any land below you? Is it being channeled in ways that are consistent with good land use design? And in terms of cutting trees and felling trees and creating too much shade and opening up sun over the creeks, we have rules about that. What do you suppose one of the biggest controversies is in any intentional community everywhere, anywhere? Any guesses?
Who does the dishes?
Who does the dishes? That's a close one. That's like number two or three if the group shares a kitchen.
Sanitation?
How do you enforce the rules? I'm going to call that a question later on in answer.
What are the rules?
But the answer is our friends, the four-leggeds, pet policies. Yeah. Does Fido and Fluffy get to be our pals in our house, on a leash, in a fence, killing wildlife, being our pals, or not? And you've never seen any more civil wars with passion and red faces and people falling out of their chairs with upset as when communities talk about this. And a lot of people at Earth Haven think that Earth Haven is having a hard time right now because this is an issue that's up, and I'm sitting there thinking, this happens all the time, you know. This is pretty typical, and we're working it out, you know. So that's one of the kinds of agreements that has to do with health. Wildlife health. Do we have rats in the kitchen or not? We have a new kitchen cat who got into the community through nefarious and illegal means, whom everyone loves. And his name is Fuego because of his fiery colored fur, and we don't have rats in the kitchen anymore. But then the people who are saying up with Fuego say, hey, he's doing a good job. And the people who are saying down with Fuego say, well, but the other kitchen over there doesn't have rats, so we'll work it out. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. Sure. Sure. Rather than repeating the question, I'll just answer it, which is the financial arrangement at Earth Haven. And by the way, this varies widely from intentional community to intentional community, and from eco village to eco village. Is that a person who comes in there first has to be accepted as a member, a full member. And then they pay $4,000, and if it's a couple, each person in the couple pays $4,000, which is a one-time membership fee, and it's not ever returned. So you have to know that you want to do it. And if during the provisional membership period the community says, we've changed our mind, Reginald, we think maybe this is not the place for you, it's given back, of course. But if Reginald changes his mind, only 3/4 or so of it is given back. We'd like to encourage people to not enter lightly. And then a person decides whether they're going to have a full site or a compact site, and whether they're going to have it alone or share it with others. A full site is approximately 1/4 acre, but don't quote me, because they vary widely depending on the site. A compact site is approximately 1/8 acre, again, about half the land size. This year, the cost, one-time lease fee, 99-year lease, renewable, transferable, which is like ownership except you can't get a bank loan for construction, is $18,000. And that's not for, somebody said to me once, $18,000 for 1/4 acre? And I say, and our streams and our forest and our 13-sided council hall and all of the other things that we have. Come on, all this infrastructure is what you're paying for. And every year, that price goes up because every year we have more infrastructure and more social infrastructure. So people who come in are paying for that. Who are they paying? They're paying back the founders who put their money into a pot in order to pay off the owner financiers. Okay. So people can share a full site. Up to 4 people can share a full site. Up to 2 people can share a compact site. We have talked about having renter options for people who have much to offer but not a lot of the way of financial assets. But that didn't pass recently, and we dropped that proposal. But it's something that comes up from time to time. We have work exchangers, we have visitors and guests, and we have all kinds of other ways to be at Earth Haven for a long period of time as a resident but not a member. You, sir. Decision-making is full consensus, and we have an agreement that says if you're going to come here and be a full member, you need to take a weekend consensus course first. Does anybody know who Rob Sandelin is? I bet some of you know him. Yeah. Rob Sandelin is a really wonderful consensus facilitator and teacher and mediator and community process consultant. He's a member of Sharingwood Cohousing in Snohomish, Washington. And Rob says, if even one person in your group doesn't know consensus, don't use it. And I, quoting myself here, say, consensus is like a chainsaw. It can chop a lot of wood. It can chop your leg. Don't use it unless you've got all the criteria for it. You have a common vision and purpose, and you know you do, and you know what it is, and you agree on it. You've all been well-trained, and I say well-trained, and thirdly, I mean well-trained in consensus. So you don't think, oh, that won't work for me. I block. Bad process. Hiss, boo. That's pseudo-consensus in my opinion. And the third criteria is that you all have equal access to power. One person is not the landlord and the rest tenants. One person is not the boss and the rest employees. Equal access to power. So, yeah. Okay, let's go to Missouri. What do you say? Well, questions, okay. No, there still will be a fee. Here's what we have in mind. Pay back the founders who put their money into what's called a shoebox bank, which is a device invented by the E.F. Schumacher Society, which is a way to have a promissory note so that people with funds can put their money into a fund, which is a temporary loan, receive interest, and then get paid back later. So once we paid them back, we'll be building the other bridges if we haven't already, but we hope we will before then. Building a large community kitchen and dining room for at least 150 people, and other kinds of infrastructure, road maintenance, and other kinds of good things we come up with. Yeah. Okay. I want to just quickly take us to Dancing Rabbit, which is in Rutledge, Missouri, which is another intentional community that is an aspiring eco-village, started by very young folks straight out of Stanford. They were... The people who started it, 2 of the 5 who started it, were computer software designers and engineers and made very large salaries telecommuting to Silicon Valley, which gave them a sort of a leg up financially to start this thing. Also, since their parents had sent them to Stanford, that kind of indicates their parents had disposable income that they could then use for friendly loans to these folks, and some of the parents did. And God bless them for it. God bless them for it. So they bought 280 acres in the prairie. Just like Earth Haven, they did a permaculture design first. They've got small straw bale cabins. Theirs look different. They have cream-colored earth plaster on the outside and white metal roofs. They do water catchment. They're not entirely off the grid, but they do have some wind generators and solar panels. Lots of little garden plots. And their aim is to be a village of 1,000 with lots of sub-communities, some of which might be income sharing, that is, classic communes, some of which might be arranged in a co-housing type manner, some of which might be just a group of individuals getting together. They're looking for flexibility, freedom, and to push the envelope. The folks at Dancing Rabbit have ecological covenants that are more strict than any I've ever seen, and they say, somebody has to be the radical, zealous youth, it might as well be us, and I'm their total fan. So here's some of their covenants. If we have a car and we come here to Dancing Rabbit, we give it up. We either bicycle or we put it into the car co-op, or we sell it and we carpool, or we sell it and we join the car co-op. But we don't individually own our old clunker and drive it with just one of us in it anymore. It's one of their covenants. Another one is we don't use lumber unless it comes from this bioregion, specifically this region, or if it's recycled, we get it from so-and-so's barn, or else we build with something else bioregionally. We're not trucking and hauling building materials via Home Depot into our place. We're going to live according to our values, put our money where our mouth is. So that's some of their values. They also use used fryer oil for biodiesel. That is, they use biodiesel. They also use used fryer oil instead of biodiesel. And they're converting some of their cars, and they're always coming up with new ways to warm up the oil so the car will start in the winter and so on. So these folks are heroes of mine. And I hope you get to meet them, and I hope you get to come visit us too. So these are examples of groups of zealous youth, and in the case of Earth Haven, zealous middle-agers, who got raw land. In one case, the land is flat and they need more trees. In the other case, the land is like this and we need to clear trees. But otherwise, we're pretty similar. In both cases, relatively little zoning regulation and few building codes, which is why we could do this. So let's take a completely different example in Ithaca, New York, Eco Village at Ithaca. Ithaca, New York is where Cornell University is and where the Ithaca Hours community currency script is. And it's a very progressive place. And so some folks got together and said, what would an eco-village look like if it was made for middle-class folks and it had the ability to influence the mainstream? It wouldn't look like Earth Haven or Dancing Rabbit. Now, they didn't exist yet, but it still wouldn't look like that. They said, let's do three clustered co-housing communities, all clustered together. We'll build our first one, and then we'll build the second one, and then we'll build the third one. Let's have a CSA farm right on site. You know, community-supported agriculture, you probably know what that is. And so they did. Their first neighborhood has passive solar-oriented buildings, much cheaper utility payments than any other mainstream place would have because how they centralize their utilities. But they don't have photovoltaic panels. They couldn't afford it. So they made their roofs have a place for it for the future, but they don't have them now. They have a common house, as in most co-housing communities, where they have children's play area, dining room, kitchen, meeting areas, laundry room, and so on. They just finished their second neighborhood, and their second neighborhood was built at a time when the health code regulations in their county say, yeah, you can have composting toilets. So buildings in the second one do have composting toilets, some of them, not in the first neighborhood. People in the second neighborhood have more money, so they have got some solar panels on some of their homes. Eco Village at Ithaca is world famous. People have studied it in Spain and Japan and in between. They have accredited college course programs through Cornell College and through other colleges in the Ithaca area, teaching sustainable design, eco village design, and so on. They're basically activists. They're not sitting at home having a good life. They're sitting at home having a good life and changing the world. One of the things they did was they put offices in the common house in the first neighborhood common house building, and they put offices in their homes so that they could induce themselves to work at home and not be putting petrochemicals putt out behind them as they drove to and from work every day down in Ithaca. So half the adults that live at Eco Village at Ithaca work at home. at least part-time and sometimes full-time. And they did that on purpose to induce themselves to change their lives that way. They also lobbied the local bus company and said, hey, would you all stop down here right in front of our building here so that we can take the bus to Ithaca to work instead of driving our cars? And because there were so many of them and they had all this eco-publicity in the local papers, that's exactly what happened. So they're activists. Any questions about Dancing Rabbit or Eco Village at Ithaca? For those of you who may not have heard this question, what's the story on teenagers living there? And I'll say there, any of those three places. And what's the source of their discontent? Mainstream culture sucks, man. Okay, discontent and community. I think that children and teenagers and young people of high school and college age have a better time in community than they do in mainstream culture living situations. Though I expect the same kinds of pressures and challenges and existential angst still plagues them. But they have a place to hang out and do it, and they have friends who are not, adult friends who are not their parents, teachers, principals, aunts, or uncles, which tends to create a whole lot of good energy. So there's been research done on children in communities, and I think that as they get older, that makes them teenagers in communities, so I'll say this research still applies, which shows that kids in community, if the community is stable, not a lot of high turnover, but a stable community, tend to be socialized at a far earlier age. I knew a kid who went to a mainstream grade school, and the other kids in grade school are standing there like this, you know, when they're in the first and second grade. And this little boy walks up to the principal and says, well, hey, hi, Phil, how's it going? Because, you know, he knew that Phil was a guy, you know, just another adult, like somebody you could walk up to and punch him in the leg if you're short, punch him in the shoulder if you're tall, and say, so, what's new? And the other thing about children in community is that they tend to be very confident. You can see that, right? And they tend to be multidisciplinarily skilled at an early age. They can fix your car, milk a cow, do your budget, facilitate a meeting. Brandy McPherson, did you see her? Did you see her? She was raised in an intentional community, Brandywine Falls. Then she lived in a Coast Salish Nation community. And boy, is she a confident person. She doesn't let zoning regulations stop her. She's one of my heroes. I hope she's one of yours. She's remarkable. I attribute it not only to her own personal wonderful qualities, the fact that she was raised right. She was raised growing up saying, all my relations. And she knows what the rest of us perhaps need to remind ourselves, which is that we're all related.
I was wondering if you had a sense, in general or maybe specifically for each of these, how much a person would need to bring in financially in order to live there, and what the range of what people in the community are bringing in, what's the distribution of wealth?
What a great question, and it's point on target. What is the kind of money that's required in each of these places, and what kind of range of wealth is there in there? My hat's off to you. Okay, Earth Haven, 4,000 and then 18,000 or maybe 10, depending on the size of the site that you're going to lease. And then from 8,000 if you do all the labor yourself and build a 12 by 12 little cabin out of straw, clay, and slip straw, and recycled windows and such, and you do labor for like a whole year all by yourself, maybe 8,000, to maybe 50,000 or more if you're building a house, or 60 or 70 or 80. I'm going to go around and ask people what they spent and do they have a budget and can I Xerox it and give it out to new members. So it depends on how elaborate the house, whether you give yourself running water and solar power. That's Earth Haven. Dancing Rabbit, you go in with a shirt on your back and you pay 2% of your annual income. And then you pay 1 cent a square foot per month, which ends up being about $75 a quarter to lease your little site, which, because they're rabbits, they call them warrens. And it's about 50, what is it? Shoot, I don't remember. Something like 50 by 50. It's enough for you to have a little hut in a garden. Why does Dancing Rabbit, how can Dancing Rabbit afford to do that? because they set up their original finances differently. Eco-Village at Ithaca, oh boy. It's a co-housing unit in an upscale, two-income professional neighborhood in a college town. $200,000, $250,000 for your house that you're going to buy? But here's where the catch-22 comes in. At Earth Haven, you have to generate up all this money yourself because, and you know the answer, we don't got no bank loans. But at Eco-Village at Ithaca, you could get a mortgage, and maybe you go in with $30,000 down, and you're in. You're just, you know, hooked by your umbilical cord to the bank for 30 years, but you're living in an Eco-Village. And, you know, somebody coming to Earth Haven who pulls out their pocket and goes, oh, damn, isn't living in an Eco-Village, so who's to say, you know? Los Angeles Eco-Village, hey, you just pay your rent in your apartment, and if you don't have a car, you get a $20 discount. I want to take us to Los Angeles next. Okay, ranges of wealth. That's a great question. You know, Americans, and I suppose Canadians, don't talk about this out loud, so let's talk about it. At Earth Haven, there is one or two descendants of wealthy families who live on trust funds. Just maybe one, maybe two. There are people who worked for 40 years, putting away 10% of their savings, sometimes 20, every month, and are now living on retirement savings and investments. There's one or two like that. There's someone who comes from a wealthy family but who didn't touch the family money and instead earned a whole bunch in a very high-paying profession and has now got rental units as an income source and invests in Earth Haven and its people. Then there's a bunch of people who hardly have any money at all and make a living through various tiny little pieces of part-time jobs and live what I call low on the hog. That's like high on the hog, only lots lower. Then there's people like myself who telecommute. I have a part-time job working for a nonprofit, which is why my clothes come to you care of Goodwill. But they're kind of nice, don't you think? They all go together. And then there's people who own their own businesses. Evergreen graduate, Karina Wood. She runs Red Moon Herbs. She owns it. She runs it. She does herbal classes, tinctures, herbal vinegars, salves. It's the largest herbal business in the Southeast. Wonderful business. Employs her full-time, several other community members part-time and part-time. Permaculture Activist Magazine makes a living for the publisher, editor, who is Peter Bain, and brings in a part-time income from various other folks, and including part-time for various of them. So that's Earth Haven. Dancing Rabbit. A whole lot of young people come who haven't been doing American life working for companies or starting businesses yet. And some of the people who founded it come from very wealthy families and earn... Oh, my God. My one friend got out of college and started earning $100,000 a year. And I just thought, oh, and I'm being a writer. Anyway, so, yeah, that's Dancing Rabbit. Eco-Village at Ithaca, presumably there are two income professional families there because that's usually who can afford to buy into co-housing. And by the way, co-housing is not usually cheaper than other housing. It's usually the same for townhouse-style dwellings in that neighborhood, whatever neighborhood it is. And quite often it's just a little bit more because you're paying for stuff that banks are nervous about. You know, like you all own in common the common house. Oh, that's weird for banks. So they might charge more, you know. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Okay.
Please.
About Earth Haven Eco-Village.
Speak up a little louder, would you, Chris?
At Earth Haven Eco-Village, it is possible. I showed up without a dollar in my savings account. That was 6 years ago. I've been making a living in land for the last five. Willing to work your ass off. Don't let the lack of money get your way.
Yes. I don't know if everybody heard. That's Chris Farmer, who is one of my heroes also. He co-founded the forestry co-op, one of the worker-owned co-op at Earth Haven, which fells trees sustainably and is clearing land for agriculture and home sites, mills lumber, and builds beautiful passive solar timber-framed and stick-framed buildings. Woo! Besides serving Earth Haven in all of those ways, sometimes 8 and up to 13 people don't have to leave the land to go make a living. And a village thrives if you're there doing it. And it thrives if people join you, and they join you if it looks, walks, talks, and quacks like a village. And it does if people are making a living on the land instead of driving off every day to work for some big company.
With all the talk of wealth, I'm curious if any of you are income tax evaders or war tax evaders?
Income tax evaders or war tax evaders? I know somebody at Earth Haven who doesn't pay taxes, but I'm not going to say who it is. A little embarrassed. Please to continue. Did everybody? Oh, I'm sorry. Did everybody hear what Farmer said? They make sure they don't make enough money to pay taxes, which so far hasn't been too hard. And individual members are it's up to them whether they pay taxes or not. And the business does not, you know, have a big brother looking over their tax return shoulder. Also, they can choose as a worker-owned co-op to not pay Social Security taxes. And isn't that so?
Well, technically we're all self-employed, so we're all individually responsible to pay or not pay our
Right. Another thing I should say, perhaps, in answer to the question about wealth, and I really should have said this before, is that, oh yeah, $4,000 and then $18,000 or $10,000. Well, that's site option one, where you pay the whole chunk as soon as you become a full member. We also have site option two, where you pay half down, and then you pay a monthly payment. And I think we're in the process of being up for reviving site option three, which is where you pull out your pocket and go, whoa, only have, what did you say, $6 in your pocket? $1 in your pocket 6 years ago. But then you go like this. And then we say, all right, okay, come here, we love you. And then the person just pays a monthly payment. That's how we have fabulous young people. Oh, I have to talk about the yin-yang symbol of wealth at Earth Haven. Imagine this, you know, black with the white dot and the white with the black dot. There's this argument that goes on, and I just want to say to people, hey, you guys, think of the yin-yang symbol. There's older people who say, those young people, they're complaining about not having money. But, I mean, I have money. I worked. I worked for 40 years, and now I'm here, and I have money. And then there's young people who say, well, those older people, they didn't be sustainable. They worked for the man for 40 years. Boo on that. And I'm thinking, well, the older people had to work for the man because that's who had the jobs. And it gave him the money to be here, to be somebody who can have a house that they can pay to have other people build for them, and they can hire other community members. And the older people are equally off, in my mind, because some of the younger people just got right out of college or right out of the Grateful Dead parking lot, and, you know, they were 19 or 22, and they just said, I'm going to live my values right now. They didn't have a nest egg. You know, they were lucky if they had eggs at all from a chicken, you know. So, like, we're both glad to have each other, in my opinion, you know, like, the generations need each other. I can't put down anybody who worked for United Amalgamated Incorporated for 40 years because now they can be in an eco-village, putting their heart and soul and life energy where their heart is, and we need them.
Speaking of which, is this kind of like a country club where you need somebody to sponsor you and then you need to...
It's just like a country club. But I mean, it's way out of the country, honey. Way out of the country. Yes, a person who comes in doesn't have to have a sponsor that already knows them. But if somebody like yourself says, hey, howdy, I was at that lecture back in February, and I'm interested in learning about membership, then we would host you. You'd be a guest, and you'd jump through various membership hoops, and somebody would become your sponsor. And it would be their job to make sure you understood what was required of you, and did you need any help, and are you needing a shoulder to cry on? Because it's just weirder than you could possibly imagine. And, you know. Well, listen, folks. It's 8:30, and we've been going all around the mulberry bush, which is perfectly fine since this is really yours to command. I wanted to mention a little bit about Los Angeles Eco Village and show you a video of some of the Earth Haven folks. How does that sound? Okay. So are you finding this a tad inspiring, if not a tad daunting? Okay. Los Angeles Eco Village. In 1992, there were race riots that scared the hell out of a whole bunch of people down in Los Angeles, which is, by the way, I never admit this in public, my hometown. And so Lois Arkin was living in a neighborhood on the corner of White House and Bimini Place in a part of Los Angeles that's sometimes called Koreatown because there's a lot of Korean immigrants there. But it might also be called Central America Town because there's a lot of Hispanic people living there. And she thought, I am not going to put up with fleeing the inner city because of riots. What I'm going to do is plant my ass here forever. And I'm going to not drive a car, and I'm going to start an urban-based, intentional neighbor eco-village. So she did. And what she did was she went around with some other neighborhood activist folks and met various neighbors and said, hi, I'm Lois Arkin. I live over there. I just have never met you yet. I'm wondering if we can have a cup of tea sometime. Would you like to come over now? Oh, come on in, Lois. Or, oh, I don't know who you are, Lois. Or, no habla español, Lois. But I mean, no habla inglés, Lois. But in any case, Lois habla español, so she could get along with that. And so people got to know each other. She would invite them to crazy, amazing things. She'd say, let's get those orange parking cones that we can borrow off the traffic folks and stick them in the street and put a big table in there and get the cars off the street and put a tablecloth on and get out Danish and coffee and cappuccino and have breakfast on the street. And then let's invite the L.A. Times down and say, we're doing neighborhood here. Well, now the L.A. Eco Village, this is like, what is it? This is 12 years later. They are the darlings of the LA Times. This is an internationally well-known eco-village. People come from Denmark. They come from Japan. They come from South Africa. They come from all over the world to visit LA Eco-Village. Oh, and they also come from Compton and Beverly Hills and Hollywood and Inglewood and all the other multiple patchwork of towns in the LA area to visit the LA Eco-Village. I am proud to say I've been there twice. Nobody owns anything. They rent. But they have this kind of association. They have a nonprofit association that Lois started, and she got friendly loans from to buy two apartment buildings next door to each other, one with 40 units, one with 8 units, and they renovated them to make them more eco-friendly because they had lead paint and all kinds of rotten stuff. They were really slum dwellings, and they all live in them, but some of them live in other buildings around that intersection. They ripped up the fences in the backyard. They planted organic gardens. They have a recycling center. They have a composting center. They have a bike repair shop. They have lots of bike activists living there. They have some community businesses planned, such as a cafe and food co-op, such as a bed and breakfast. Some of the members actually make a living staying at home in Los Angeles, which is a really good trick, being housekeepers, doing bike repair, maintenance, and other kind of repair for other people in the neighborhood. They've put in a grant to Chrysler saying, we would like you to give us a grant of 10 electric vehicles and we'll make a car co-op and promote the hell out of your generosity and your sustainable visionariness, oh Chrysler. They've asked the city of Los Angeles to help them with funds to create a slow street there. They do all kinds of inner city activism. They are fabulous. They're fabulous. Any questions about LA Eco Village? A slow street is where you fix it so that cars can't go speeding through your little residential neighborhood. So you put up barriers and trellises and things that the cars have to slow down, speed bumps. Think Mark Lakeman in Portland Repair, City Repair. Okay. After the video, I want to tell you some ways that you can visit eco-villages and how you can learn more on the web. And how you can learn lots more at Lost Valley this summer, where there's a 2-month sustainable living course with permaculture design, natural building, eco-village. Mark Lakeman will be there. Brandy McPherson will be there. I'll be there. There'll be all kinds of cool stuff happening. I'll tell you about that. I'll tell you about Northwest Intentional Community Association, the folks of whom are here in the second row, and what good things they do in their meeting on April 3rd. But first, let's meet some Earth Haven founders from the horse's mouth telling you why they're doing what they're doing and how hard it is.
to build an alternative.
In the beginning, we wanted to have a kind of a neo-primal village, and we
decided that we would build these little huts for people to come and live temporarily while we built the community center and then built our homes.
I feel that I'm living in a really fine, upscale human habitat because I have a marvelous yurt that I live in, and I have a shower with running hot water. But many of our members really feel like living in Earth Haven is primitive.
Right from the beginning, Earth Haven's been an end run around the banking system. We underfinanced originally, and then we set up this Earth Shares Investors Collective to finance a property.
So what we've done is incorporated many of the principles of the land trust into our legal structure. We want to make sure that the land won't ever be divided up or in some legal dispute with someone's heirs. Our covenants and our guidelines help ensure our original intent to protect the land base into the future.
A lot of what we're oriented to here is doing for ourselves, taking back control of our own resources, our food, our water, our energy, our shelter, right here.
We need to build our homes out of materials that are renewable and available and in a non-destructive way. When I build my house for values, it's probably the clay straw on most of the walls and cob to be the thermal mass that brings in and holds the heat into my home.
We also are very interested in reforming the code at the state level, and we're actually engaged the state building code officials in a dialogue around trying to work toward the acceptance of some of these natural building methods.
The soil that we inherited here is almost non-existent, so our top gardening priority is to create soil. And the way we create soil is with mulch beds. So we simply lay down straw, manure, all of the different organic matter that we can lay down in a layer. And now there's earthworms where they didn't used to be, and there's soil where they didn't used to be, and so there's plants where they didn't used to be.
Our community is 100% off the grid. All the power we use right now is either photovoltaic, generated from the sun, or hydroelectric. Earth Haven has purchased a portable bandsaw mill so that we can mill our own lumber off our property. And it freed us from the big timber companies, freed us from the whole building materials industry.
If we can bring economics away from the dollar and back to the ecological activities of this region, we'll be able to come a long way to bring this world back into sustainability.
We have our own community currency. It's called leaps and bounds. And one leap is worth an hour of labor or its negotiated value in goods and services. Folks trade leaps for building materials, child care, health care, community fees, and a variety of things.
We're harvesting raw materials from the land. We're adding all the value to it ourselves, and we're selling it directly to people who we know and who are our friends and who live in our community with us.
A lot of times when we're doing work projects here, there'll be more men involved than women. A lot of the women are afraid they don't have enough skills to be useful or afraid that they won't be strong enough to do what needs to be done. I think it's frustrating for both genders that it ends up being that way. But right now, I'd say there's more women than men that are in the leadership role.
We govern ourselves by a process called consensus. It informs all of our social relations. The idea that everyone is a piece of the truth and we can only arrive at it when everyone is willing that we should go forward with a decision.
So the subject comes up that obviously needs more talk, and there's a bunch under the rug, personal conflicts. We'll call a special meeting, but there's not necessarily a decision to be made. We all kind of sit down and hash it out. Usually by the end of one of those meetings, there's a pretty amazing sense of fellowship and a pretty amazing sense of open-heartedness.
Living in the tribal village, we are very much on display and we are very much in each other's lap because we share this one building that functions as kitchen, communication center, hangout spot, the library, the place to plug in your tools. So a lot of path crossing goes on there, and sometimes we step on each other's toes and we cross each other's paths. And of course, sometimes we embrace each other, all about 90% of the time. That's one of the magnificent and healthy and untradeable things about Earth Haven is the number of hugs that you get here.
Ultimately, we're just a bunch of ordinary people attempting rather extraordinary things. I think if we're to succeed, then we need to show or demonstrate how people can live high-quality, resource-conserving, socially rich, rewarding lives without stealing from future generations' inheritance.
Can I have some lights? Thank you. Okay. I wanted to let you know how you can find out more about eco-villages, visit them, take courses at them, and so on. And then give you just a little bit more information, and then have way more questions if you want them. So, first of all, Fellowship for Intentional Community is an organization that serves to network, help community seekers, help communities. The website is ic.org. They publish Communities Magazine. They publish the Communities Directory. They have biannual board meetings and public events. And the Visions of Utopia video is available from them, as are all kinds of books from Community Bookshelf. So that's ic.org. Global Ecovillage Network is gaia@ecovillage.org. Ecovillage Network of the Americas, which is South and North America, is ena@ecovillage.org. Co-Housing Association of the U.S., cohousing.org. Northwest Intentional Communities Association is ic.org/NICA. And you are invited.
Slow down?
Sure. Thank you for giving me communication feedback. Northwest Intentional Communities Association. Would you all stand up and let folks see you? This is some folks from that organization. And they are members of various communities in Washington and Oregon. And they do regional organizing to benefit people in communities and people interested in communities. And they have a meeting that you're invited to on April 3rd at Sangaya Co-Housing Community in Bothell, Washington, www.sangaya.com. And what they're going to have at this meeting is Stories of Community, a workshop about how to recruit and orient new members, a tour of Sangaya, potluck dinner, which is $5, and they provide childcare, and you're invited. You can talk to any of these folks afterwards. Lost Valley Educational Center this summer in July and August is going to have a two-month course on eco-village design and sustainable living. And you can see Mark Tobin right here in the blue vest afterwards if you're interested. Lost Valley is also an inspiring eco-village, aspiring and inspiring, in Dexter, Oregon. Okay. Communities Magazine, a little plug from our sponsor. If you're interested in communities and you're not subscribing to this baby, I just want you to call me up and tell me why. Because this is a really good magazine. Lots of wonderful people write for it. And it's just so well edited. Here's my baby. We're all out. There's no more to be sold to you here today, I'm sorry to say. But you, if anybody's interested in what it's about, is what Ecovillage and intentional community founders that were successful, what they did, and what the ones that weren't successful did, and how you can know how not to reinvent the wheel. It covers getting off to a good start, vision and purpose, governance, power, and decision-making, agreements and policies, legal options, finding and financing land, zoning, neighbors, internal community finances, site plan and design, communication process and how to have good conflict resolution, and my most controversial chapter, selecting people to join you. So if you know anybody who's interested in such a tome, it's available through Community Bookshelf, which is store.ic.org.
What's the title?
Creating a Life Together, Practical Tools to Grow Ecovillages and Intentional Communities. So, In 1998, the United Nations named eco-villages in their top 100 list of best practices. So this is not entirely countercultural. The UN noticed them. Earth Haven is a positive response to the world crisis, says Chuck Marsh, and that was the fellow in the red plaid shirt that you saw at the last part of that video. It's an opportunity to figure out how to live socially and ecologically responsible, spiritually conscious lives in right relationship with the natural world. We desperately need living examples, and the best examples to be found are in the eco-village movement. We stand at the junction between two millennia, says Albert Bates, who is the Eco-Village Training Center director at the farm in Tennessee, and who is a member of the board of the Global Eco-Village Network. The past millennium was about building societies that ran on fossil sunlight and on militarism. The next millennium, still a mystery, must be more conscious and humane or we won't survive. It's on the shoulders of eco-village pioneers that the dream we all have now rests for peace, security, prosperity, family, and happiness for ourselves and for our generations of children, whether we or they recognize it yet. A few more website addresses. LostValley.org, DancingRabbit.org, EcoVillageAtIthaca.org, LosAngelesEcoVillage.org, and EarthHaven.org. You're invited to come visit at Earth Haven. info@earthhaven.org. If you want to visit us, let us know. I would like you to imagine we're on a hot air balloon. We're in the gondola made of wicker in a hot air balloon. We're floating over the countryside. It's 30 years into the future. What would that make it? 2034. We're floating over the countryside. It's emerald green because we're in the Pacific Northwest. And below us we see CSA farm after CSA farm. We see intentional community after intentional community and eco-villages dotting the landscape below. Because we're clairvoyant and we can read the minds of the people down there on the ground, we know what they're doing. They make decisions by consensus. They're getting along with each other well. They have really good methods for communication and process and conflict resolution. They're growing their own power from the sun, from the wind, from streams. They're recycling their waste. They're doing gray water recycling. They're doing all the good stuff. And they're getting along well, and they have hearts. They're feeling connected to each other. And they're looking up at us. And they're saying something to us. They're saying something. So we drift down a little lower so we can hear what they're saying. They know who we are. They say, up there, that's the Greeners and those guests they had at that conference. And you know what they're saying? You know what they're saying to us? Because of the way they're living there now? You know what they're saying, don't you? They're saying, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for doing what you did back in 2004. That's all. Leon's question is, would I give a little synopsis of the 90-10 and the six major things? Okay, sure. In a nutshell, I came up with this idea that I made up. This is not some professional thing. I just made this up. By the way, if you're leaving now, that's fine and God bless you. It's not. I don't think it's rude. Goodbye. Thanks. I think structural conflict is a thing whereby when you're starting a community or any kind of endeavor, and there's certain structures that you need to put in place in the beginning so that it'll be successful, but you don't know you should because you haven't done this before, so you don't put them in place. And then you end up in horrible conflict with your fellow community members or your fellow organization members a few weeks later, a few months later, a few years later, because you didn't put those things in place. And although it looks like Hildegard is being irresponsible or Reginald is being a real butt, the fact is, it's just a structural conflict. If the structures had been in place, you probably wouldn't be having this argument. And so I don't I think that, of course, there's interpersonal conflict, and there will always be. And by the way, is there any in communities? Oh, yeah. Just like in regular life. But if you put certain structures in place in the beginning, you can really reduce the likelihood of certain major kinds of conflict. So here's the six things that I've identified. Someone else would have sliced this pie differently. Keep that in mind. This is just me. Okay. Common vision and purpose. We know what it is. We know we've got one. And we know that we're all in agreement with it. It's the most important thing we can do. It's the first thing we should do when starting an eco-village. If we have... We have a fair participatory decision-making method. We can all make decisions that influence the outcome of the decisions that affect our lives. If it's consensus, we get trained in it. If it's consensus, we get trained in it. And if it's consensus, we get trained in it. Okay. Third one, clear agreements in writing. Has anybody ever been in an organization where we're all trying to remember that decision that we made? And it wasn't, some of us remember the beginning of the conversation and some remember the end. And was it 4 weeks and $500? No, it was 7 weeks and $600. And we think that the other person is either out to lunch or trying to cheat us or they've suddenly gone brain dead. All we have to do is go look it up. It's not that people are trying to cheat us, which is why we should write it down. It's because human memories remember things differently. My friends in community are sitting there going, okay. We know what we need to know. We're not going into this community venture thinking that we already know everything we need to know. By the way, is forming a new community like getting married, like starting a small business, or like going on a long overseas trip with a huge, complex itinerary, lots of equipment, and need for many maps? Oh, yes, you're right. It's all like all of those. So what would we need to know? We need to know left brain things and right brain things. Right brain things, or you might say heart things. How to get along well. How to do good process and communication. How to resolve conflicts. How to do visioning together and come up with a common vision. How to do decision making together. How to speak from the heart. How to be honest and self-revealing. Left brain things. We need to have a business plan, strategic plan, budget. We have to know how escrow works. What the heck is escrow anyway? We know how to get private loans, if we need to get private loans. We need to know how to make money flow, cash flow projections. We need to know about taxes and insurance and stuff like that. Hey, wait a minute. Why do we need to know stuff like that if we're going to be an eco-village? Aren't we being an alternative to mainstream culture? I mean, we have to do that? Yes. Yes, we do have to do that in order to create the place in the first place so that we can go live there and then be an alternative to mainstream culture. Okay, know what you need to know. That's the fourth one.
How do you balance the left and right brain thinkers so they're not in conflict with each other?
They are in conflict with each other. You just have to have good process. Also, if we are left brain people primarily, and we know who we are in this room, don't we? We need to thank our right brain friends and our people who want to just, you know, ohm and meditate a lot. We need to thank them for helping us know why we're here in the first place. And if we're on the right brain side of the equation, and we know who we are, we have to thank our left brain friends for keeping the cash flow straight. So we need each other, just like we all do anyway, because why? We're all related. Okay, number five, good communication and process skills that we learn right off the bat from any number of workshop leaders and books and all kinds of ways we can learn it. And we get good at it now in the early days when we don't have horrible conflict, the same way children learn fire drills when there's no fire. Because will we have conflict later? Yeah, we might as well learn this now. And the last one, here's a controversial one. Choose new members and new founders on the basis of emotional maturity. Select for emotional maturity. This is where people kind of throw rotten tomatoes at me sometimes. If you've got any, get them out now. Okay, because we want to make ourselves have the best possible chance of success. And a whole lot of unsuccess can happen if we're a new group or a small group and Reginald or Hildegard comes into our group and they have so much difficulties that they're going to drain and exhaust our group and our meeting time. I see some people nodding their heads. Oh, you've experienced this before. Because they're having big difficulties in life. And they want our help and our time and our attention, and we're giving them our time and attention, And we're giving them our time and attention, and we're giving them our time and attention, and we're not even getting our business done. And then some of us are getting so fed up and pissed off, especially the more left brain and, oh, come on, I don't have so much time, and I got to get the job done. And they're leaving our group, and we're losing them. We're taking these people, Reginald and Hildegard, who only mean well and who really just need a place, and would we please accept them and we please love them like they wish their parents had but didn't, and would we please, you know, like just like give them what they wanted all their life forever. But we're gonna evict our most go-get-em members if we do that. So I'd say wait until you're 300 people and 30 years old and then let Reginald and Hildegard in this special program called How Can We Help You? That's the six things. Predominantly vegetarian or vegan communities? I don't know of any vegan communities, and I believe that you can use the community's directory to check in the chart on diet for those that might be vegetarian. But caveat emptor, because at Earth Haven it says vegetarian. And that's because once we had a militant vegan, that may sound like an oxymoron, but frankly it wasn't. And she put down that we were vegetarian probably as an affirmation. And we're really a bunch of omnivores, so sometimes people come there and they're shocked. So call the community and find out if it's still true what it says in the community's directory. You can also check websites. By the way, visiting communities. It's a wonderful thing to do. There's a protocol about it. There's an article about how to do it in the current edition of the community's directory. The spring issue of Communities Magazine, which I want you to buy, is all about that. And you need to check with communities first. Do they have a visitors program? Do they have days and times and hours? What should you bring, by the way? You should bring work gloves and be prepared to use them, and because you want to help them work, right? And it's a wonderful thing to go visit communities, but you need to know their rules.
I'm wondering if your community is patrolled by the local police force, or how you deal with that as an issue. Are there any warnings to have a police presence there or not?
Oh, boy. The question was, do we have beneficial help from the local police force when or if we need it? Our relationship with our local neighbors is extremely good. I don't know what our relationship with the police is because I have no idea if we ever see them. But we recently have had some stealings out of cars in the middle of the night, apparently, and we don't exactly know who it is, but we don't think it's anybody that's staying at Earth Haven. We think it's people walking in. And we have had a number of suggestions for what to do, and sometime during this time that I'm away from Earth Haven has been a meeting that I don't know what the outcome was on security issues at Earth Haven.
I was wondering, it was mentioned before, but how, if you had any problems or how you plan to enforce rules.
Oh, right.
Or how anybody else has
them. I think the average community has a very difficult time enforcing their agreements if someone breaks them, because when they're getting formed, it never occurs to them they'll ever have to think about this. But they do. And so a whole lot of communities go from a kind of the founders are somewhat naively thinking that, we'll just make these agreements and then we'll all agree to them. And then we'll go into a community life and life will be wonderful forever. And nobody will ever break them. Nobody will ever break a policy agreement or a behavioral norm or do anything that's like bad or nasty. But people do. And so I recommend having a system of accountability where we all help each other stay accountable to the group in terms of the things we've agreed that we would do. I also recommend that we communities have what I like to call a graduated series of consequences. Consequences, ooh, it has a mainstream culture ring, doesn't it? In mainstream culture, our consequences are fines and jail terms and putting people down and making them wrong and shaming and blaming them. I suggest a system of a graduated series of consequences where the person who is the offender, the perpetrator, as they'd say in the police station, is not shamed or blamed, and there's something very kindly and mild that draws their attention to they need to follow that agreement. And if they don't, something kindly and less mild. And if they still don't, something kindly and just a little bit more strengthening, such as ever more increasing publicness that they haven't paid their dues or something. Also, intervention by individuals can help. I have a couple of friends at Earth Haven who sometimes do things that I consider, and some other folks consider, violations of our agreements. So I go to them privately and tell them that it's painful to me that they're doing that, and would they please quit it? So that's the kind of thing I recommend. I'm not sure what they do at Dancing Rabbit, but I know they're dealing with it right now. You know, this lady and then this lady.
What do you do in someone's absence to make a consensus decision? Like you're not there for this meeting. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you just have to live with what you decide?
Exactly. I believe that generally the way the consensus is taught is that someone chooses not to go to a meeting because they cannot or they wish not to. They basically live with what the decision is. But keep in mind, in a well-trained group, that person's opinion will be known and people will take it into account. Also, the person can say to you, because you're going to be there, hey, this is how I feel about that orchard issue. Would you please let people know what I'm thinking while I'm gone? And you will, and I know you will. This lady over here. You're talking about the amount of influence that people who might have more experience or their founders, if they've been there longer, have.
Right. I'm wondering if that can be stopped or if that doesn't exist in some places that you have been.
I don't think it doesn't not exist nowhere. Or to put it in better English, I believe that it happens naturally. But before we go on, I'd like to check with some folks. This is a kind of a community process thing. You can tell I've been in a community a while. Some of you may very well want to go. And some of you may want to stay and schmooze. And I'd like anybody who wants to go to feel free to, because I wouldn't want you to feel like you're captive here. You know. I also think my friend Chris wants to go. And I'd like to be able to say goodbye to you so you can go and then hang out with all the rest of you. Can I go up and hug Chris goodbye? I can tell you need to get somewhere. Thanks. I'll see you in 2 weeks or so.
We're on the mic.
Oh, yeah, well,
good night, Diana.
Good night. Thank you for coming. It's wonderful to see you again.
If you do find yourself inspired by this conference, by Diana, by all of this, and are a student or a community member, and would like to get involved in next year's planning, we all knew that we can get because most of us are graduating. So please contact one of the faces you saw on this stage and let us know what you can do to help. Thank you.
So those of you that are hardcore and want to talk about this some more, I'm willing if you are. And all of those that are leaving, goodbye and bless you and thank you. Maybe that's it. Oh, your question. Would anybody like to hear more about that hidden power issue thing? Okay. All right. The question is, first of all, is it common or uncommon that there wouldn't be a lot of influence from the people who are older, more experienced, or are founders, or have been there longer? And I have some assumption-busting questions for you all. But first of all, I think it's pretty common. And I think that whether it's healthy or not healthy depends upon how the power of influence is wielded. So I'd like to do my 45-second wrap on power, if I can. This knowledge about power changed my life. is from a book called The Guru Papers by Joel Kramer and Diana Alsted. And they said, power is when a person or system influence another person, other persons or systems. It's neither good nor bad. Influence, power is influence. And then they said, authority. Authority is when somebody has a lot of power to influence because they have a lot of experience or charisma or expertise or an inherited title or a lot of wealth or something rather that makes them have a lot of influence because they have a lot of authority in a particular area. Hierarchy is a way that human beings and tissues and cells and solar systems organize themselves sometimes to accomplish a certain goal. It's very efficient, gets things done quickly. It's neither good nor bad. Authority, it's neither good nor bad. Authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is when someone in power with a lot of influence, with a lot of authority at the top of a hierarchy punishes or ignores or abuses you because you don't do what they say or you don't agree with them. And that is bad, they said. And they said a whole lot of people confuse power with authoritarianism, authority with authoritarianism, and hierarchy with authoritarianism. And I read that and I went, holy mackerel. And all of the 60s fell away from me. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have power. And it's okay. I have power in some circles. This one. I have no power in banking circles. You have power in the circles you have power in. You have the power to influence. You can think of the circles where you have the power to influence. It's kind of a good thing because you're influencing people in benevolent ways, I'm sure. So how are these founders or these older folks or these more experienced folks using the innate power to influence that they have? Are they benign and beneficial? Are they sharing power? Are they looking at people in ways that are, hey, like we're all together in this? Or are they doing one of those mainstream culture things and you have to kick their butt once in a while? I think that it depends. Does that address your question? I'm sorry it's not a better answer like, no, I've never seen that. Here's another one. In the 90s, I've not seen any spiritual communities who wanted to have a guru and spiritual practices with one guru get started. But there are plenty of them that got started before the 90s. And sometimes what they have is a guru who is a celibate and who suggests that people be celibate and become swamis, or who suggests that the married couples be rather restrained. Now, those communities, when they have scandals, they are inevitably sex scandals. And then there's communities that are all about equalness. None of us shall ever have more influence or power than any other ever by virtue of being struck by lightning. If anybody should ever presume to know something more or be better at anything than anybody. The Australians call this the tall poppy syndrome, which means that if a poppy in a field rises up above any others, you cut it off. Egalitarian communities, if they ever have any scandals, it's power scandals. Interesting, huh?
It seems like from my limited experience and the examples you've used, communities are more or less monocultural, at least in a loose sense.
Monocultural?
I mean, I'm wondering for examples of multicultural or more diverse.
Oh, right. Oh, this is my favorite question.
Like, okay, you know, Earth Havens, obviously.
White bread.
Yeah, or hippies, you know, which is cool.
Hey, I object. Did anybody bring Rotten Tomatoes? I want you to get them out now, because I'm going to say controversial things. But I've warned you. First of all, most communities that I know of, particularly those involved in ecological sustainability, were founded and are filled with middle-class to affluent, well-educated or self-educated European descendants. Some cohousing communities I know have Asian people and sometimes Hispanic people, but not that often. Mostly if they have anybody that isn't European descendants, it's Asian. Two income professionals of Asian descent. LA Eco Village is extremely multicultural. Relatively few African Americans, probably relatively few, if no, Native Americans. Lots of Hispanic folks from other countries, lots of Korean folks and or Asian folks from Southeast Asia there, and European descendants, and people from Europe. what I often see is that white people say, gee, I'd like to be in a diverse community. We want more diversity. I want to be diverse. And then some part of my brain goes, do you want that because you really want to be allies to people of color, or do you want to feel like you're cool? That's what I think. I try not to say it out loud. But I think it. And I'm thinking, do you want to have a self-image as a cool, diverse person? Or do you genuinely want to be an ally to somebody of color or to a population of color? Various communities that I've known of white people have said to a nearby population of people of color, hey, would you like to join our community? And the folks have usually said, well, thank you, no. But we have our own community, and we already have it. If they're Hispanic, they already have it. If they're Asian Americans, they already have it. If they're from India or Pakistan, they already have it. If they're Arab Americans, they already have it. If they're black, they already have it. Or maybe they don't, but they would like to, and they get together, and then they say, thank you very much, but no, you could come to our potlucks. You could help us. So here's what I like to say to white folks, and you know who you are. If you want to be of help to people of color, please ask them what they want. Don't presume that they are just eager to jump into your community because you guys are so cool. And here's another phenomenon. Oh, my, get your tomatoes out now. Because I've seen some white people in community who wanted to have diversity, right? And so, but if you could read their subconscious, it would be like this. We really want you people of color to be with us, but not too many. Oops. So here's what I think, if you don't mind me being so opinionated. Go ahead and recruit from populations other than European descendants if you want to. But please be prepared to be politely told no thanks. And please be prepared to turn it around and say, hey, I hear you folks are creating community. We are too. Maybe we could share some resources. Here's what we've learned so far. Here's a really good bank manager, good for loans. Here's a really good land site planner person. Here's a really good permaculture designer. And by the way, do you need a loan? And by the way, do you need us to come over on Saturday with our work gloves and help you paint the garage? Be truly helpful rather than merely cool white people. That's the end of my controversial statement. You can put the tomatoes back now. Well, what do you think? Be honest. Oh, I'm getting some nods.
Has there been a lot of research into finding out how people have been sharing the strategies that people that group together by culture and race have had, including Latino communities, Black communities, and Amish, and try to? Has there been a lot of sharing of ideas?
Do you mean have people who are European descendant people wanting to form community gone and learned from other kinds of existing communities?
Well, no, just kind of studies in community mapping or anything like that. There are a lot of articles on the diversity of issue, what they're talking about now. Or have there been a lot of studies?
No. Perhaps I shall intuit what your question is. Okay, I'll do that. Yes, we did have an issue called diversity homogeneity in community about 7 years ago. And it was co-edited by Tree Bresson. Do you know Tree Bresson? She's a consensus facilitator. She lives at Walnut Street Co-op in Eugene. And a wonderful person and a friend of mine, been involved with the communities movement for years. And she was a co-editor, and Ira Wallace was a co-editor, and Ira Wallace is an African-American member of Twin Oaks community. Oh, by the way, what do African-American members of Twin Oaks community have to say when their well-meaning European descendant friends, a.k.a. white people, ask them, what do y'all think? And they say, well, first of all, this community is not clean enough to attract black people. And secondly, you don't honor children enough. We'd like to have children, and Hispanic people would say the same. And thirdly, she says, frankly, it's just too weird here for us. But Ira's there because Ira's a fairly flexible and amazing person, so, you know, her social life and her business life is there. And so they co-edited the issue, and there were a number of articles which helped me get this understanding that I now have, which is, hey, you well-meaning white folks, thank you very much. See how you can be allies instead. Now, academic folks in colleges and universities quite often study intentional communities. Professors of sociology, history, political science, and new religions in various universities around the country have this fascination for intentional communities, and they call me up, and they want to give me their academic paper, and I say, write it in layperson's language, or we ain't talking, Jack, you know? But I do read their papers, and they'll write about the Amish, or the Hutterites, or the Quakers, or the Shakers, or the polygamous Mormons of Short Creek, Colorado. Whoa. And so, I mean, I get to learn a lot, but quite often they're written in such academic language that, you know, it never sees the light of print in my magazine. So, yeah, there is some studying going on. I bet you a Google search, let me try that again, a Google search would show the names of articles in academic journals. Good luck reading them. And you and the new. I'm just doing consensus facilitation, sorry. Well, that's, did everybody hear what Jordan said? You're talking a little low, and I'm thinking the folks behind you might not have. Okay. A common vision and purpose isn't necessarily a common culture. And I think, oh gosh, that's such a complex question. It's sort of like a Mobius strip or something. Let me try to do it different. It seems to me that it's hard enough to do community when you're all of the same culture. If you had different cultures, where you have different communication rules, like, and I want somebody Hispanic to help me out here because I don't know the real story here. But I have heard that in Hispanic culture, it's exact opposite of Anglo culture, where you look at people when you're talking to them, but look away when you're listening, or the reverse, or something. And so you can get big misunderstandings and think somebody is not being respectful or not paying attention when in fact they're doing their very best respect. But in that culture. So that's just one example, and I don't even have it straight in my head which it is, but think of all of the different kinds of cultural misconceptions in communication that you could have between different highly specific cultural groups and derivative from different parts of the world groups. And then just think about the communities that you know already and how hard it is already to get along well with good communication and process skills. I think it's adding another layer of challenge and possibly very well worth it. But I don't know of any communities that are doing that. Now, maybe what you're saying is, are there any communities that I know of who've said, okay, our vision and purpose statement includes that we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and this is why, and we want to be multicultural. And I don't know of any. However, LA Eco Village is multicultural already. And heck, they're just on the same left coast. You could go visit them anytime. You know, and I think I'd like to ask them, how does this work? You know, sorry, I don't have any more information than that. Okay, thank you. The question is, at Earth Haven, and I'm going to translate it to Dancing Rabbit as well, are there rules and agreements about building methods, and is there a stricture against stud framing or using plywood, which I confess, oh, Father, forgive me, I have sinned, I've used plywood. And what do we do about it when someone egresses against that? Transgresses, thank you. Different communities have different kinds of rules, and I think they make them relatively flexible based on abiding by ecological covenants and guidelines that the individual group of people have created, as well as making it economically affordable for the homeowner or the home leaser. As you probably know, it's more expensive to build natural than it is to build conventional, unless you have a whole lot of free labor, and you have free labor because at the time You're not out working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. If you are working and you have to hire people to do all that labor-intensive work, you're paying 2, 3, 4 more times that you'd pay than if you built a stick-framed home by a conventional building crew. Do you folks know that? I mean, maybe you don't believe it. Maybe I'm wrong. But that's what I've seen so far. And so at Earth Haven, and I'm guessing at Dancing Rabbit, people try to strike a balance between not requiring things that are so strict that the person can't even afford to do it. Because there they are in the rain and the mold, and they don't have shelter yet. Let's get them some shelter. So I was cut some slack. I got Hisbu plywood from Home Depot. Now, I could have gotten plywood from Forestry Stewardship Council, FSC, approved plywood. But first of all, they don't sell it in the Southeast. You have to get it shipped. It costs twice to three times as much, and it takes 8 weeks to get. Well, they root around to get the right paper to certify that this was grown on a woodlot where they harvested it sustainably. But you can get sustainably harvested plywood, but you still have all the formaldehyde, right? And so my place is stick-framed, made of lumber from the land, and milled sustainably on our land, and money that I paid to it went to the forestry co-op for milling it. And I paid more for it than I would have if I'd bought it from Home Depot. But they lost 20 cents a board foot on the whole deal because they're trying to make it affordable for me. And was I helping them or hindering them from buying their wood? When they didn't have the wood I needed because they don't have every dimension of lumber in the sizes or the lengths that you need necessarily. It depends on what they've been cutting down and milling in the last few months prior to that lumber order. I did not buy it from Home Depot. I bought it from a local miller, a private guy who was a neighbor of ours. And he got it from unsustainably logged forest, but at least I was buying bioregionally. And then I went to Home Depot and got caulk and other stuff. Insulation was blown in cellulose. Roof is green metal, which means that we're doing roof water catchment. It's passive solar building, and the thermal mass is something I invented, which is full-length patio door replacement doors on the south side with stacks of paver stones up above the window to make a kind of semi-short little tram wall thing. And that's the thermal mass. I made it up. Chris Farmer, who was just here, his micro hut, 12 by 12 by 12 with a loft, is made of timber-framed posts and beams milled, harvested on the land and milled on the land, and with a green metal roof, blown-in cellulose for the ceiling insulation, chip slip, which is wood chips in a clay slurry that makes like a straw clay wall, but it's made of what we have at Earth Haven, which is we have a whole lot more wood chips than straw, because we don't have any straw, because we don't have any grain, because we don't have any waving fields of grain up there in the mountains. And so we have wood chips from the sawmill. And then he has earth plaster on the outside and the inside, and the inside has a clay alise, is that how you say it? A-L-I-S. Made of lilac-colored mica. It's one of the most beautiful buildings at Earth Haven is Chris Farmer's building. And then he has all kinds of beautiful built-in stairways up to his loft. And he says, I've got a bedroom, a guest room, a living room, a dining room, an office, and a bedroom in that place. And that's because they're all like a piece of furniture or a built-in counter. You stand in his house and you can touch every part. And you can go up stairs, you know, and then his desk is under the loft of the bedroom. And it suits him fine, and it costs him $8,000 plus approximately $8,000 of his labor if he were to pay himself. So those are two extremes, my building and his. Did everybody hear the comment? What happens when a community has to confront that it might need to revisit its values and its vision because of economic realities? Yes, that does happen. And I believe that different communities resolve it in different ways depending on the circumstances. And I would say that mostly the communities will take a short-term reduction of their previous agreements in order to just continue to exist. I don't think I've ever seen a community that said, well, if it's between continuing to exist and being according to our environmental principles, or altering them and not continuing to exist and keeping our principles, or altering them and changing what we're going to do, at least temporarily. I haven't known any to choose to stop existing. But maybe it's some habit I don't know about. And so that brings up, oh gosh, is it hard to do this and stay in integrity? You betcha. And that's why the permaculture principle of, what's it called? Transitional strategies is a good thing to keep in mind, which is that we're doing X now so that we have a base camp so that we can do Y later when we can do it better. Does that address your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you be the last person so that you can leave and the lady whom I'm about to go do my next adventure of the evening and I can go as well. How to help more people across everywhere know about sustainable living alternatives quickly?
And to be able to actually start to do it. What kind of things are going on for that?
I have that same wish. I was breaking my heart to see all those 90% falling down on the ground in lawsuits, in court, duking it out with their hard gladiator lawyers when just a year before they'd been the best of friends trying to share resources and be in harmony. Absolutely broke my heart. So I said, okay, somebody has to let people know what tends to work. So I've been talking with Toby Hemingway and Joseph Kennedy about the phenomenon of writing a book or wanting to write one about a trend that's like a wave that's just about to crest, you know, or maybe it's just a little wave that's way out there and it's going... And nobody knows about it hardly. So you go and write a book about it because you're trying to have art imitate life, imitate art. So you're trying to have a book that says, hey, look, everybody, look at this thing. And then people look at the thing, and then the thing goes, oh, people are looking at me. And then it gets to be more. So that's what Toby said. Oh, I wrote this book about permaculture in the garden, and oh, it's really taken off. And Joseph said, oh, I wrote this book about natural building, and oh man, people are really taking off on this book. And well, me too. You should see who's calling me now that this book that I did is out. And so that's only the beginning. There's all Liz Walker's book on Ecovillage at Ithaca, and the two other books, Don't Tell My Friends, that I have up my sleeve that I want to do. I want to do one called How to Join an Ecovillage. It's the other side of the coin. It's how to find them, assess them, visit them, be a really good guest, go through the membership program, and deal with the come-here-go-away phenomenon that you'll find, and enter like a wolf enters a wolf pack. Bare your throat, let them growl over it for a while, and then they'll let you in. So I'm going to do that one. Joseph is going to do a book that's one that I wanted to have happen, and thank God he's doing it, because now it's going to happen. Photo essay book of various eco-villages around the world. I think that with videos and television and documentaries and green and progressive media people who are getting more and more excited about this. I mean, I've been interviewed by the New York Times and the LA Times just because people say, oh, you ought to talk to her. And, you know, that, and so I tell them all kinds of stuff, you know, like to get this thing moving. More and more of this is happening all the time. Yeah. Well, shall we call it an evening?